This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for Mr. Joel Hilliker today. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Thank you for having me.
And from Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
One of the major developments that the Trumpet has been expecting is for Germany to begin playing a much larger role in the Middle East, even a leading role with several important nations. And this week, we saw what could be some major developments toward that end. For this, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, we have two stories that happened this past week, which indicate that Germany is looking to get involved more fully in the reconstruction efforts in both Lebanon and Syria. Now, Syria, for its story, Syria's been at war for the past 10 years. And right now, the country's led by Bashar al-Assad and has been by him and his father for decades. And Syria is allied with the Iranians. And because of that relationship, this civil war has been precipitated for a decade, as I said, coming to the point now where the country is absolutely demolished. 90% of the population lives below the poverty line. I think they have 10 million internally displaced people. It's a horrendous situation. And the only way that Syria is to find its way back to the path of recovery is to get a lot of foreign investment into the country, into the rebuilding efforts. Now, there are countries that are lining up to do this. Germany just back at the end of March, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas pledged that they would be willing to spend $2 billion towards the reconstruction in Syria, except that will only come without, quote, substantial political processes. There will be no reconstruction. Basically, if things continue the same way and Assad is just answering to the Iranians, we're not given any money. That's what that means. And yet Germany is offering out a carrot there to Assad to decide whether he wants to stay in bed with the Iranians or whether he's going to moderate it somewhat and come closer to the international community. So you've got Germany offering money for Syria. The other place that Germany is offering money, and this is due to is from a leaked report from two diplomatic sources. This is for Lebanon. Now, everyone will remember that massive explosion that took place in August in Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, which blew up the whole port of Beirut, and then it ended up causing 200 deaths. And Beirut right now is still absolutely destroyed, the whole coastal area there around the port. And they are after money. And France and Germany and others have been willing to put forth money. But again, there is an Iranian ally that is in control of that nation, that being Hezbollah. And now with this report that's coming out, and Reuters released this as an exclusive that came on Friday, Germany to propose Beirut port reconstruction with strings attached. And this means that, again, here's a lot of money. We're willing to give it for you in form of a loan. But for this to happen, there's got to be a political process that takes place, which means, again, Iran has to relinquish its control, or meaning Lebanon, you have to find a way of stopping Hezbollah from governing in a way where it acts as Iran's puppet. And so here we've got two stories in the space of a week that Germany is going right at the throat of a couple of Iranian proxies saying that here's a bunch of money on the table. You need to relinquish some of your reliance on Iranian leadership, be it for Lebanon and Syria. And we'll see. There's no response as yet, but Lebanon's in a horrible way. There's riots every single day, bread lines every single day, rolling blackouts every single day. This used to be like the mecca of the party capital, Beirut, of the Middle East. And now it's turning into a backwater because of Iran's control over the nation. and other nations not being willing to fund an Iranian government.
Well, as I mentioned, this sort of deeper German involvement with certain Middle Eastern nations is something that the Trumpet has been expecting. Could you talk about why we've been anticipating this?
Yeah, I mean, it's these two stories on their face, they probably don't seem like they should headline this show, apart from the fact that biblical prophecy does say definitively that there is going to be an alliance between a German-led Europe and these specific nations, Syria and Lebanon. That's a prophecy that's found in Psalm 83. It details an anti-Israel alliance that, if you look at in the terms of the Middle East geopolitics right now, it's also an anti-Iranian alliance. And so Mr. Gerald Flory has written in the King of the South booklet and in other places that this alliance with Germany and it will end up involving the Gulf states as well as Turkey, as well as also Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, that this does show that Iran is going to lose sway over these two nations in particular. Syria and Lebanon abound in terms of biblical prophecy to move away from Iran and instead form a relationship with a German-led Europe. And so when we see Germany really coming into Iran's backyard and tempting these allies of Iran with money to move away from Iran, we can see how this biblical prophecy is going forward. And we wrote about how this would be the result of the Beirut explosion back in August. We said, watch for Europe to get more involved in this reconstruction effort, and watch for the Lebanese themselves to get fed up with Iran and actually reach out to Europe. And so we will be watching this over the coming weeks to just see whether Syria and Lebanon are willing to make these reconstruct or these changes in terms of their domestic politics, meaning you need to reconstruct the country or your policy so that you don't rely so much on Iran. And that way, it'll open the door for more German influence over these nations that is going to help split them away from Iran in favor of Europe and the international community as well.
We will be sure to include a link in our show notes to the article, The Beirut Blast, Catalyst for Biblical Prophecy, and we'll also link to an article called Germany Offers Syria $2 Billion for Political Change. So check out both of those to understand this development in the prophetic context. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we will stay here in the Middle East for a look at a massive deal that China just made with the Iranian government. For this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, on March 27th, the Chinese and Iranian governments agreed to a new trade deal, and it is absolutely monumental. It was organized by the Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers in Tehran, and the main feature of this deal would be that China will invest $400 billion U.S. dollars into Iran over the course of 25 years. This deal was only organized now, but it's been in the making for a little bit of time. It was first announced in 2016 when Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Iran, and it's taken a little bit of time for it to get going, but it seems to only have started now, probably because with the new Biden administration, U.S. President Donald Trump was notoriously hostile to both Iran and China and wasn't afraid to heave around America's economic clout to stop things like that from getting done. And considering that Joe Biden has been in the White House for only a few months, it didn't take Beijing and Tehran to get going with this deal. The Chinese will invest in a lot of different areas in the Iranian economy, including infrastructure, healthcare, banking, but crucially, also its nuclear program. And the deal includes a provision for transfers of military technology. So as we will be discussing about Iran later, the Iranians are notorious for their A, nuclear weapons program, and B, support for terrorist movements around the world. So this deal is surely going to help them out quite a bit in that. This is $400 billion. This is an absolutely mammoth size amount of money. And Iran is a bit notorious for using of foreign investment and other things that were supposed to be diverted to certain parts of its economy over to its military program. So this is going to be empowering Iran quite a bit in this way.
So it's easy to see why Iran would welcome this, what basically equates to a huge infusion of Chinese money into their economy. But what's in it for the Chinese here?
Well, there are a couple of things. Iran, for its end, agreed to export oil to China at a heavily discounted rate over the 25 years. The Chinese, of course, they're a major industrial power. They're a major fossil fuel consumer. So this enables China to have a steady supply of oil. And it also involves China increasing its footprint in the Middle East and in Western Asia, that sort of region, as it's been doing with a number of different countries through its Belt and Road Initiative, creating economic alliances with the smaller powers, third world countries, to increase the power of its currency, but also just to cause the world economy to revolve more and more around China. But this deal with Iran, this isn't just another deal with another third world country like it did with some other countries like Sri Lanka, for example. In this case, China and Iran probably see each other as allies of convenience. Both are under U.S. sanctions. Iran, of course, has been pressured by the United States government quite a bit to curb its nuclear program and has been on the suffering end of U.S. sanctions. But China's been on quite a few sanctions as well due to its things like its genocide against the Uyghurs, its dissolving of Hong Kong autonomy, its sponsorship of nuclear North Korea. And while the Trump administration has been quite tenacious in going after China's economy, the Biden administration, due to, I'm sure, a lot of outside pressure, has been reluctant to put the brakes on those sanctions. And China's noticing that things aren't going back to pre-Trump days as quickly as it would like. So in a sense, you could almost consider this perhaps blackmail even against America to show that, hey, look, if you don't start opening up your economy and taking away all these tariffs and sanctions, we're going to start using our economic clout to fund America's enemies. And it's not China, it's not just Iran that China has been funding lately. Of course, its sponsorship with North Korea has been for a long time. It's recently been taking up economic engagements with Cuba as well. And it's increasing its oil importation from Venezuela, another American enemy that's also a pariah state suffering from American sanctions. So in a sense, this is China's way of getting all of America's smaller enemies on its side, perhaps to pressure the United States to back off on its sanctions.
Mihailo has an article that just went up on thetrumpet.com about this. It's called China Promises Iran $400 Billion in New Deal. So we will include a link to that in our show notes. Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. We'll take a look at the UK now, where the nation has been shocked by reports of rampant sexual abuse in schools and universities. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's being likened to the Me Too movement, but in Britain's education system. The website Everyone's Invited was set up last summer to record reports of sexual abuse experienced by people while at school and university. And to date, it's accumulated over 13,000 reports of people going through this kind of abuse. I mean, for the most part, these reports are from girls being harassed or even attacked, generally by boys their own age while they're going through school. And it's covering students. Girls are reporting attacks even that took place during elementary school years. Britain's National Police Chief Council Lead for Child Protection, Simon Bailey, he warned that now every police force in Britain will soon be investigating these kind of reports. He said, "I think that there is a huge societal problem with what young men are viewing online, the sexualization of women and the complete blurring of those lines in terms of what is healthy in a relationship." So it has become a big deal at the national level. The government has set up a special helpline that just went into effect yesterday so that victims can call and get help or even report attacks to the police. They're launching a new nationwide investigation into the problem. And it's a story, I think, that has just completely blown open a shocking aspect of Britain's education system that has just kind of been under the radar or swept under the rug for far too long.
So it sounds like they've really identified a big part of the problem here. You know, they mentioned what men and boys are viewing online and how that makes them treat women and girls. You just have to wonder, though, in a society that really celebrates pornography and often champions it as some kind of a display of free speech, will there be any real action against that, which I think is a foundational reason why all this abuse is happening?
Right. I think it's a foundational reason. I think there's a lot of this that's not being confronted. And I think you look at the way that society has dealt with pornography in the past. You know, it's not nobody is surprised that exposing young children to massive amounts of online pornography does bad things. Nobody is surprised that massive amounts of our young people are exposed to that pornography. And has anything been done about it in the past? Yeah, there's been lots of talk, but nothing's happened, and you think that probably nothing will happen again. And I think what you're seeing with this story is something similar to what we saw with the Me Too movement, where there was a genuine problem, and then everything rapidly goes in the wrong direction looking for solutions. You know, the Me Too movement kind of very quickly became people being accused without due process of law and kind of got taken over by the feminist movement, and quote unquote toxic masculinity was under attack. And, you know, all men need to holding an entire gender responsible. And there's worrying indications that we're seeing something similar. You know, all these accusations that go online are often anonymous, but at the same time, people are making public accusations with names attached, or they're putting enough details that people can be identified. So you're having teenage boys now who can barely show their face outside their house because they've been accused, and there's been no kind of due process surrounding that. There was a school in Australia that caught the headlines recently because they made every boy in the school stand up and apologize to all the girls. We're seeing a kind of a worrying shift to that same narrative. And a lot of this particular problem at least initially revolved around private schools. Private schools are dramatically overrepresented in those making the complaints. I think the majority of them are private schools. And I think there's partly a problem there in terms of the very wealthy kind of viewing child rearing as yet another task that they can outsource and pay someone else to do for them. And that just doesn't work. And it doesn't work, especially in this dangerous culture. But going back to the point that you made about pornography, you know, I've seen a lot of buck passing. I've seen police officers and governments talking about, well, we need to do more in the home and parents need to do more to control what their children are watching, which I think is right. But then I've seen articles from quite a few parents saying, well, stopping our kids from watching pornography is just impossible. We need the government to step in and do something, and they're refusing to kind of take responsibility. I don't think there's going to be any, at the end of the day, a lot of this just gets down to parents, family, all of society. You know, parents, yes, they see the problem in pornography, but they're not willing to take away their kids' smartphones. They're not willing to deal with their internet access. Governments, they'll point the finger. They're not willing to do anything, or they're not willing to step in and deal with, say, the entertainment now that's so common, and the music that children are listening to that describe depraved sex acts, even sexual assaults that they then copy on their peers. I think pornography is being seized upon because it's something simple and tangible and definitely has a lot to do with this. But at the same time, I think this is a problem that involves every aspect of society, and it's a problem that it's very hard to see Britain acting on, given what we've done so far.
So, Richard, you're going to be writing an article about this. Could you let us know a little bit about when we can expect that, and also what the prophetic analysis will be there?
Yeah, I think this is a crucial story to understand, and I hope to have something on it, finish it on Monday. But we talk about, in quite a number of the stories on this show, God punishing Britain, America, punishing our societies. Why do they need to be punished? And I think stories like this answer that question. You know, that punishment is coming for a very positive reason. It's to build a better world for our children. And without that, we're having a world that's getting worse and worse and worse in horribly depraved ways. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 5 really nails it, where it talks about the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. And it goes on to describe, you know, there are problems at every level in society. Isaiah 57 and verse 5 says that our society is slaying the children in the valleys and under the clefts of the rocks. And Mr. Flurry in the Isaiah booklet, he said, anciently, the Israelites sometimes physically sacrificed their own children. Today, we sacrifice our youth spiritually when we give them no uplifting vision. We sacrifice them to sexual lust and fornication. And he talked about some stats that are now woefully out of date. I mean, you see stories about like this, and that is what we are doing. We are sacrificing an entire generation of young people. I mean, what is this doing to their chances of success, of having a happy marriage, a happy family? And even the teenage boys that are doing this, this is what we as a society have educated them to do. So I think, you know, this story shows us why our societies need that correction, and then the positive results of that correction too. You know, God is stepping in and he is saving our young people.
Sounds like that's going to be a very powerful article, so we have a lot to look forward to there. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll take a look at a $2.3 trillion spending package that President Biden is determined to push through. It's dressed up as an infrastructure plan, but a look below the surface shows something quite different. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the American government is getting more and more radical by the day, it seems. There's an article I saw in the Wall Street Journal saying that Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders lost the Democratic president nomination, but you wouldn't know it from President Biden's first 2 months in office. And then it points to the fact that there was a huge $1.9 trillion COVID-19 bailout that wasn't really giving much money to COVID-19 relief. And now there's another $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill that doesn't actually allot much money to infrastructure. So altogether, that's $4.2 trillion in spending earmarked for the next decade. So huge, huge boosts that are either going to affect our tax rates or the national debt, or likely both. And the interesting thing is a lot of the people that have gone through this deal have found that actually this huge $2.2 trillion infrastructure deal is only about 5% about traditional infrastructure, roads, bridges, things like that. Most of it is, or at least a huge portion of it, is subsidies for green energy and payouts to unions for like green jobs.
Yeah, you wrote an article about this week. It's called Democrats' Radical Environmentalism is a Trojan Horse for Totalitarian Government. And I think you make a really interesting point in there about how this infrastructure plan could transform America into a Venezuela-style socialist state, really, by nationalizing the energy industry. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, because the Green New Deal, I'm sure everyone at least in America has heard of the Green New Deal. It's this radical proposal to spend trillions of dollars shutting down the fossil fuel industry and converting America to green energy. But because free market forces aren't pushing the nation in that direction, it's basically the federal government stepping in and shutting down what types of energy production it doesn't like, and subsidizing with taxpayer dollars the type of energy production it does. And so, I mean, that is an enormous federal power grab, possibly the biggest federal power grab in history, which would be very similar to, like I said, what Venezuela did in a weird sort of way. I guess Venezuela nationalized the energy industry and then like sold oil. This would be nationalizing the energy industry, shutting down oil production and switching to wind and solar. But yeah, then the people looking at this infrastructure bill, they're liking it to like a Trojan horse, because they said they couldn't get people to vote for this radical Green New Deal, but they're taking many key elements of it and then slipping it into the infrastructure bill, to where now it's actually more about Green New Deal programs than it is about infrastructure, just to get those plans in through the back door.
So Presidents Obama and Trump both tried and failed to deliver a sweeping infrastructure plan. And the failure was largely because of broad political opposition to the tax increases or the national debt increase that would be required. Does it look like President Biden will be able to overcome the opposition and get this plan passed?
Well, there are several Republican senators who've come out pretty strongly against it. One of them, Senator Ed Markey, said that this is a way of accomplishing the goals of the Green New Deal. Even liking this, he said this is going to bring like absolute socialism to America. So it looks like the chances of it getting passed are probably going to hinge largely on whether the Democrats can get rid of the filibuster or not. I mean, they could use the Vice President Kamala Harris to be the tie-breaking vote, unless Republicans filibuster the bill and never bring it to a vote. So that'll be interesting to see in the weeks and months ahead. But it definitely does reveal the ambitions of the radical left, just the fact that something like this is being seriously considered. Like I said, it would push America more towards a state where you've nationalized the energy industry in the name of environmentalism. And I guess the ironic thing is that it probably wouldn't even help the environment a ton. They're talking about like electrical vehicle charging stations, but those are still plugged into the electric grid, which is powered by fossil fuel. Or shutting down those fossil fuel stations, but you've had rolling blackouts in both California and Texas this year, largely because their electric grids are too reliant on green energy that sometimes can't keep up with the demands that are being put on it. But there's a article we'll put in the show notes on what the Paris Climate Change Agreement was really about from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. And he really points out just the irony that like some of these deals, like the Paris Climate Change Agreement and now the Green New Deal and this infrastructure deal, they're being pushed forward saying that we basically need to nationalize the economy to save the environment, but they're based on some fraudulent science that really exaggerates the effect they'll have on the environment and are really more about socialism and government control than they are about the environment. But he has a quote in there where he says, "The governments most in favor of confronting climate change are the socialist, Marxist-type governments that want to control everything. Most of the money collected for climate change initiatives goes towards these types of governments. Governments direct research money towards studies aiming to reinforce the notion that such regulation is necessary. Contrary information is ignored or discredited. Climate change has become something like a religion for the radical left. They believe it as an article of faith, regardless of the evidence." And that article really does show that this is really just a convenient excuse to weaken America's economy to the point where we can't compete with our international competitors like China, and weaken it to the point where the federal government can take it over because the private sector is too weak to resist them.
What was the name of that article again?
What the Paris Climate Change Agreement is about.
Okay, we will include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. We'll also link to Andrew's new article. It's called "Democrats' Radical Environmentalism is a Trojan Horse for Totalitarian Government." So please check out the show notes for links to those. Thanks very much, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with those links that I mentioned to the literature. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more about these important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about efforts to restore the Iran nuclear deal, the EU's bailout fund, a defense deal between Japan and Indonesia, and Russia entrenching itself more deeply in America's periphery. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
President Biden is working hard to return the United States to the disastrous nuclear deal with Iran that was built largely by his predecessor, Barack Obama. To learn the latest about this, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yes, it looks like we're finally getting to the negotiating table now. Breaking story on Friday afternoon from the Wall Street Journal and then AP is that next Tuesday there is going to be a sit-down involving all the members of the original JCPOA. So that includes the European nations, and then the Iranians will be there, obviously, and the United States is going to be there, as well as Russia and China, of course. This was something that has not happened yet, even though President Biden has been working with his team, which largely consists of the very same people that negotiated the deal back during Barack Obama's time. They've been trying to get Iran to negotiate, but there have been no formal negotiations. There have been discussions that have taken place through European intermediaries for the past few months. But now it seems like they are at the point that they are all going to sit down together. Whether or not the United States talks to Iran or not directly, they'll be in the same building, and there could be shuttle diplomacy between rooms by the Europeans, which happened the first time round as well. But what we have here in this is really something that the Biden administrations want to do, to get to immediately. They signaled to Iran that they wanted to sit down at the table, discuss how to get back into the very same deal that was negotiated the first time, with some additions, they've said. But whether that happens or not, it remains to be seen. But now they are all going to sit down at the table together. That's the big news today.
So what do you expect to result from these talks? What are we hearing from the Iranians and the other parties involved?
So the Biden administration has reached out publicly three times in the past few months to the Iranians to try and give some temporary sanctions relief. One of these actually happened this week through a story leaked through Politico, which the U.S. floated, which said that Iran, if you stop enriching your uranium to 20%, then we will allow a lot of limited sanctions relief, meaning we'll give you a bunch of money to do that. And the Iranians said, no deal. We are going to continue to enrich to 20%, and we don't want your sanctions relief just yet, which is a really big sign. I mean, this was this would have been a wonderful thing for the Iranians. I mean, the JCPOA says they can't enrich past 3.6 or something like that. 20% is 90% of the way to a nuclear bomb, 90% of the way of the purity to a nuclear weapon. And so the Iranians said, no, we won't do that. And I think that what the Iranians were doing through all this these delay tactics was to see how desperate the United States was for a deal. And the very fact that the United States has continuously over the past 3 months offered a deal, was rejected by the Iranians, made it even better, it was rejected by the Iranians, made it even better, it was rejected by the Iranians. Now the Iranians say, okay, let's go and discuss the whole thing. The United States has revealed what it's willing to give up to get a deal, get a full comprehensive deal, not just a piecemeal deal that was being negotiated, that the Americans look like they were after initially.
Could you remind listeners why this Iran nuclear deal is just such a staggeringly terrible deal?
Well, there's lots of points to it. I mean, one is the verification process. This looks like it's a deal that is meant to stop Iran from getting a bomb, except it's very hard to verify whether Iran has actually stopped trying to get a bomb. We know they want one. We've proven that they want one. And the Israeli intelligence has proven that through some covert operations back in 2018, that there is a project for them to build a bomb and that is ongoing. So really, it can't be verified. Two, Iran benefits from it because they do not have to stop any of their other very dangerous conventional warfare, if we can call it that. They are allowed to continue to do what they do through their terrorist proxies. The JCPOA does not constrict Iran in any way. They're allowed to continue ballistic missile technology, ballistic missile testing, which allows it to create the weapons delivery system of a nuclear weapon. They haven't been that bothered right now with the whole speeding towards the bomb. because they haven't had any way of delivering it. And now, in the meantime, they've been very busy doing that. Now, what's interesting about this is that really what they're going to insist on is that not a new nuclear deal, which gives them another 10 years before they can access a nuclear weapon. That's what the old one did. It said in 2015, in 10 years, there's a sunset clause which allows you at that point to develop a nuclear weapon. We are already 6 years along in that process. And so if they agree to a new deal, that means that Iran in the next 4 years will have a fully United Nations, America, England, all these negotiators, fully sanctioned nuclear weapons program by 2025, which is absolutely crazy considering Iran has done nothing to stop its horrible behavior. If it's willing to use all the weapons it has right now at its disposal to take over Iraq, to use them in Yemen, to use them against the Saudis or the UAE, then why would the United States allow Iran to get access to far greater, more destructive weaponry? Obviously, this is not something that is good for the world. We fully expect Iran to continue marching towards the bomb. Bible prophecy doesn't say whether they're going to get it or not. However, it seems like the United States is doing all of what it can to push Iran in that direction. In the meantime, give it access to all the money that it would want as well.
Any literature you would recommend for listeners who would like to understand Iran's role in Bible prophecy?
Yes, I think people can definitely go ahead and request it's about 100 pages. It's the King of the South book. It goes through the biblical prophecies related to Iran's rise and what the Bible says Iran will do in pushing the world towards World War III.
We'll be sure to include a link to the King of the South booklet in our show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll head back over to Europe, where a German high court has blocked ratification of the EU's post-pandemic recovery fund. For this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, on March 26th, the German Constitutional Court ordered the German president not to sign off on legislation that would ratify the EU's new massive bailout fund. Over some of their concerns about the legality of that. It is a temporary block. The tone of it, though, is noteworthy. Typically, the court requests that the president doesn't sign off on it. I don't think I've seen them order the president not to sign it before. They are clearly signaling that there are some things in this bailout fund that they are not at all happy about. But what I think is notable here is we're seeing the German Constitutional Court play the very significant role that they have played kind of all along since the Greek crisis, all the way back in 2008, when it comes to Europe's push towards an economic superstate. We've talked time and time again about how these kind of crises that you see hitting Europe one after another, going all the way, whether they're financial crises, whether they're COVID, whether it's the fallout from COVID, it's pushing Europe to turn into this superstate. And each time they take steps towards being that superstate. Now, those steps are probably not as huge as a lot of people within the European hierarchy would like. They're kind of guarded. They take them as their forced to take them generally, but they take those steps. And those steps just about always involve somebody getting access to German funds. And the German Constitutional Court always steps in there and ensures that there are conditions to those funds. So the response to the bailout is this kind of unprecedented 750 billion euro fund. Also, it perhaps more significantly than the money itself, is it allows the European Union to pool its debts. They get to come together and they can borrow money as the European Union. And this is the first time that the European Union has been able to do that in any meaningful way. It's something that's much more associated with governments. You know, governments tend to be the ones that get to borrow money, not what supposedly are a free trade area. So it's a big deal. The Constitutional Court is stepping in there and making sure that this does not become a free-for-all on Germany's credit card, that this is not something where lots of other countries all across Europe can just spend whatever they want, borrow whatever they want. And so what this does and has done at every few years, in effect, is kind of what Brent was talking about earlier for the Middle East. Yes, you can have German funds, but you know, we're not going to just hand over those funds willy-nilly. There are conditions, and it demands us having a say in how that you spend that money. And the Constitutional Court always makes sure that Germany, the German parliament, is in command of that. It's understandable from the German point of view. You know, would America want Canadians or Mexicans to kind of be able to have free access to the Treasury's funds or the Fed's funds, the Federal Reserve's funds? No, they wouldn't. So you can understand that. The effect, though, is that each step of the way, as Europe becomes a superstate, Germany remains in charge.
Could you just briefly put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and let listeners know what they could read to better understand that?
Well, once again, I'll point to that article that we kind of keep coming back to at the moment on this show, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy. I think this has got to be at least the third week in a row that I have referenced it, because it's such a fantastic roadmap for what to expect from Europe. You know, Mr. Flurry, in that article, it clearly explains the Bible prophecies, clearly explains how this response to coronavirus, this kind of leaping upon every crisis, is an opportunity to build towards a superstate. It's a great place to go to learn about this. And it's another aspect of this story. You know, by stepping in, the German Constitutional Court is making sure as well that this bailout fund doesn't solve Europe's economic problems. And so they'll need to go back to Germany and they'll need to have more conditions granted before the problem is solved. So the Bible talks about, and Mr. Flurry goes over in that scripture, that article, in passages like Revelation chapter 17, that there's going to be a superstate that comes together. But then there's other passages like Isaiah chapter 10 that talks about Assyria or Germany in modern Bible prophecy that makes clear that Germany is going to be in the driving seat of all of this. And that is exactly the way we're seeing this kind of COVID bailout continue. And so that article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, is a great place to go to learn more about it.
Thanks very much for that, Richard. For our next story, we'll take a look at warming ties between Japan and Indonesia, specifically in the realm of defense. For this, we'll turn it back over to Mihailo.
On March 30th, Japan and Indonesia signed a defense agreement in Tokyo. They were called the 2+2 talks. They involved both countries' foreign and defense ministers. And it's a real synchronization of their militaries like they haven't done before. The deal includes a lot of different provisions. One of the main ones is that Japan commits to sell 8 Mogami-class frigates to Indonesia. This is pretty important because the Mogami-class frigate was only unveiled by Mitsubishi earlier this year. It is a brand new piece of technology, state-of-the-art. It's designed to be stealth capabilities with a new design that makes it harder for a radar to detect. It comes equipped with aquatic drones for hunting mines, long-range anti-ship missiles. It can be equipped with smaller crews than most other ships of its kind. And it also has Japan and Indonesia participating in joint military exercises. And crucially, it also involves Japan and Indonesia agreeing to develop remote Indonesian islands in the South China Sea. And this is the kicker, which sort of shows where this defense agreement is mainly aimed at. And the Japanese foreign minister, Toshimitsu Motegi, would agree with that. He said about the deal, quote, referring to India and Japan, "They also share serious concerns about the continued and strengthened unilateral attempts to change the status quo by force," unquote. And this was a veiled reference to China. China, of course, is the main antagonist, you could say, in the Asia-Pacific region, and especially when it comes to the South China Sea. A lot of different countries have territorial claims to the South China Sea. China has been challenging those claims by unilaterally annexing a lot of offshore islands in the middle of the sea and turning them into basically military bases. It infamously did that with the Philippines by taking the Paracels and Spratly Islands and turning them into military bases. The International Court in The Hague, the case came to The Hague, and The Hague ruled in favor of the Philippines, and China is yet to relinquish that. And that's making a lot of countries in the region nervous, especially Japan and Indonesia, who are both island nations and who aren't on the friendliest terms with China either. And both are G20 economies. Both have enormous populations. Japan has well over 100 million people. Indonesia has over 200 million people. So this is really two heavyweights in the region coming together to join their forces to stare China in the eye.
So the Book of Revelation, as long ago as that was written, it actually has a lot to say about the camaraderie that we're now seeing between some of these Asian nations. Could you briefly talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Revelation 16, verse 12, mentions a prophecy about an end-time power block called the Kings of the East, referring to east of the Holy Land. Revelation 9, chapter 9, verse 16, talks about this power block having an army of 200 million men. That's an astounding sized army, and one that can only be fielded from Asia, of course, which is east of the Holy Land. And this agreement with Indonesia isn't the only one Japan's been pursuing. It's been creating military pacts all over the region. It's done with one with India last year, did one with the Philippines, it did one with Vietnam. And already, if you just put those five nations together, you almost get 2 billion people. So that's well on its way to forming its military. We at the Trumpet watch for Russia and China to enter into the fray at this point. At this point, this alliance is mainly made against those two powers. But when an outside power, which those countries wouldn't be expecting, as the Book of Revelation talks about, challenges them, you could easily see China and Russia looking to other Asian nations to come together. And we're already seeing these other Asian nations come together expecting some kind of conflict with a major power. So they're already getting into that mindset. And it won't take too much to combine this forming power block of China's enemies and China and Russia and these other countries to come together and form a military colossus like we've never seen before.
Mihailo has an article about this Japan-Indonesia cooperation and just the broader picture of Asian cooperation that'll be going up on thetrumpet.com soon. So please keep an eye out for that. Thank you very much for filling us in on that, Mihailo. And for our final story of the show today, we're going to take a look at a trend that is bringing Russia into the U.S. periphery in an alarming way. For this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, this is probably one of the biggest overlooked stories of the week, but there was a high-level Russian delegation led by the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Yuri Borisov that was touring the Caribbean this week, specifically making some stops in Venezuela and Cuba on March 30th, meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and signing 12 major agreements on energy and finance and a plan to put COVID vaccine into Venezuela. And then after finishing that agreement, stopping by Cuba as well. And making some pretty dramatic statements there, calling Cuba our key partner and reliable ally in the region, and talking about some Russian-Cuban friendship and mutual respect interaction. So a bit of talk there, but it's something we've covered here on this program and at the Trumpet website before, just how much Russia and China are courting Venezuela and Cuba and even Honduras and other nations in the Caribbean with military deals and patrol boats and a number of both military and economic agreements because of its strategic location. Now, half of all of America's seaborne trade goes through the Caribbean into the Gulf of Mexico ports. And so any power that wanted to attack or besiege America would need control of those sea lanes through the Caribbean. the Soviet Union prioritized relations with Cuba for that very reason. And both Russia and China are reviving those policies a bit here and a bit there today, which is really leading to a dramatic prophecy highlighted in both Deuteronomy 28 and Isaiah 23. Deuteronomy 28 prophesying that the end-time Israelites, America and Britain, would be besieged in their gates, so there would be foreign powers taking over those sea gates like the one in the Caribbean. And Isaiah 23 getting a little bit more specific as to who's doing the besieging, talking about three end-time power blocks, Tyre, Tarshish, and Kittim, that dominate the world economy in the end time. And in chapter 7 of his Isaiah End Time Vision booklet, it's entitled Building Towards a World Catastrophe. Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry really highlights that Tyre represents the commercial center of the Holy Roman Empire, the modern European Union. Tarshish is a name for modern-day Japan, and Kittim's a day for modern-day China. And then there's some other there's a parallel account in Ezekiel 28 that links Russia, Meshach, and Tubal into that alliance as well, even though Russia's economy is military powerful, but its economy is smaller compared to Tarshish and Tyre and Kittim. But we are seeing, like Russian military and Chinese military might moving to those vital sea gates, which is a pretty sobering harbinger of the ultimate fulfillment of those prophecies.
We've got an article that'll be going up on thetrumpet.com soon. It's called Russia Pulls Venezuela and Cuba Deeper into Its Orbit. So keep an eye out for that, and also see our show notes for a link to Mr. Gerald Flurry's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, which gives a thorough explanation of all the prophecies that Andrew was discussing there. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We're now coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Noctegal. And we'll leave you today with these words from Dwight D. Eisenhower. Leadership consists of nothing but taking responsibility for everything that goes wrong and giving your subordinates credit for everything that goes well. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.